You know, leftist teachers and administrators are indoctrinating the next generation. That's why the conservative student in your life needs Young America's Foundation. Students ages 13 and older can apply for YAF's individual membership program and connect with like-minded students, learn from leaders of the conservative movement, gain skills and materials to advance their ideas, and much, much more. Apply today at www.yaf.org and receive a free membership pack. Again, that's www.yaf.org. Please check it out. The Rittenhouse closing arguments. Kamala Harris sadly let down by Joe Biden. So, so sad. And Beto 3.0. We'll discuss all this more on this edition of The Editors. I'm Rich Lowry. I'm joined as always by the Right Honorable Charles C.W. Cook, Alexandra Zan de Sanctis, and the Sage of Authenticity Woods, Jim Garrity. You are, of course, listening to a National Review podcast. Our sponsors this episode are Ball and Branch Sheets and the Thinking Fellows podcast. More about them in due course. If you listen to this podcast on nationalreview.com, we're delighted to have you, but it'll be easier for you and better for us if you made us part of your feed at any of the streaming services out there, from Spotify to iTunes. And if you like what you hear here, please consider giving us a glowing five-star review on iTunes. If you don't like what you hear here, please forget I said anything. So Jim Garrity, drama in the courtroom yesterday. We're recording late Tuesday morning here. You had the closing arguments. The defense closing argument, I don't think was that counsel was not particularly adept. It should have been a tighter, more kind of narrative-driven presentation, in my view. But the great advantage he has is that the facts and the video are on Rittenhouse's side. And the prosecution tried to argue that Rittenhouse provoked everything. He pointed a gun, which I guess is in his gun, which is in dispute. There's this big argument over this blown up photo, and that Rittenhouse should have run faster and kept going instead of turning around and confronting Rosenbaum, who had nearly caught up to him, which apparently, according to the prosecution, is Rittenhouse's fault. And then Great Heroes confronted him because they thought he was an active shooter. And the guy whose arm Rittenhouse nearly shot off, Grosskurtz, is that his name, was on the verge of retreating, and it was really no big deal that he was pointing this Glock at Rittenhouse, and he wasn't pointing the Glock at Rittenhouse until his arm was already disabled. So long story short, Rittenhouse forfeited any right to self-defense by provoking this whole thing, by bringing a gun to the scene and not availing himself of all the opportunities he had to retreat, or, as the other prosecutor said upon rebuttal of the defense closing arguments, or fighting Rosenbaum with his fist. What do you make of it?
Longtime readers of National Review will notice that I don't really cover or write about big trials very much. I am not a lawyer. I do not play one on TV. And I generally leave it to the Andy McCarthys of the world, people who really know their way around a jury box, former prosecutors, people who have been in a lot of these trials and things like that. And I think the lesson of when we have these big trials, let's see, probably it was my sophomore year of college, junior year, somewhere in there, so the O.J. Simpson trial. In 1994, almost the entire news world stopped as everything focused on O.J. Simpson and the double murder trial there. The lesson I think I took from O.J. Simpson's trial was that what you at home are seeing in when a trial is televised, when you have one of these big high profile trials of the century, the legal arguments that make sense to you and that the arguments that seem really compelling to you may or may not be all that compelling to the people in the jury box. Juries are weird. Juries do not necessarily, they're seeing everything on paper. They should have a better sense of what's going on, but there are no guarantees. They go into that deliberate, and you never know how it's going to shake out. So I think that's, you know, Ferguson trials, George Zimmerman, things like that. I think the other thing we have witnessed, though, with it seems like an increasing acceleration year by year, are the political and kind of cultural war factors leading into the enforcement of the law, and that this has become a very racially charged case. And it is a case in which you see prosecutors going after someone, I suspect pursuing charges against a suspect that are probably more than they would otherwise if it was a obscure case, because they feel enormous pressure to nail somebody to the wall and to make sure they got them on the most severe charge they could plausibly charge, not a lesser charge and have him plea down or something like that, which is what happens in the vast majority of criminal trials. The folks I follow who are following this trial much more closely make it sound like the Rittenhouse trial has been a disaster for the prosecution. The one part that I think has jumped out the most to me, and that I feel like reflects the prosecutors taking the cooking spaghetti approach to legal arguments. You just throw it up against the wall and you see what sticks, was the moment when the prosecutor picked up the rifle. Now, it was not loaded. He assured everyone it was not loaded, although I don't know if he necessarily demonstrated and checked for everyone to see. Held it up, put his finger on the trigger, and swung it and pointed around the room. Now, I suspect this is actually attempting to generate an emotional response in the jury, to make the jury feel frightened, to make them feel what the people must have felt like when they were staring down the barrel of the gun, which, oh, by the way, is one of the things that Kyle Rittenhouse was doing on that violent night. Look, to the extent I've been following this and what I've been saying, it sounds like Kyle Rittenhouse, who's not a hero, who's not without flaws, who is not someone who is, I necessarily want to see celebrated. It appears he acted legally in self-defense in a dangerous situation. That is probably going to outrage a whole lot of people who've gotten really wedded to this, this simple political narrative of crazy, angry young white males, gun-toting maniacs, spurred on by Trump, racist, blah, blah, blah. And that's the heart of the problem, is when, you know, complicated, ugly, you know, situations get turned into these simplistic narratives, and people also seem to believe that if they, you know, the jury doesn't come back with the answer they like, they're entitled to smash things and very often see if they can get a flat screen TV. That's always the right answer to some sort of, you know, terrible social crisis, is to break into a store and steal something.
So, Zan, I think Jim's right that Rittenhouse isn't a hero, and I think it's a mistake of people to try to make him into a hero. But he was a person in real circumstances, and one of the worst aspects of our national life the last 2 or 3 years is, like, everyone wants to reduce people into symbols. So, you know, actually, Rittenhouse didn't shoot any people of color, but still he's been made into this supposed white nationalist because he was on the wrong side of the riots and the protest. He was against the disorder and was there to protect property. So he must be bad. So there's this tendency, therefore, to reduce everything about him into this symbol. So he can't sincerely be upset about this traumatic event. So his breaking down on the stand was fake, or their white tears that somehow shouldn't count. I mean, since when did tears have races now? And there's just an unwillingness to take this guy, you know, as a 17-year-old who might have had good intentions but had poor judgment, and to decide on the basis of the facts and the law whether he's actually guilty of these serious crimes he's being accused of. Rather, his guilt is taken as a premise, the starting point of the conversation.
Yeah, I think we've been witnessing this in a lot of contexts. I mean, think back to what the horrible situation that Brett Kavanaugh was subjected to during his confirmation hearings, and how, you know, his name was dragged through the mud based on stories that couldn't be corroborated, and how several people on the left, prominent people, Democrats, commentators, one Democratic senator I'm thinking of, who said, you know, was asked, well, do we think these accusations are true? Do we know that they're true? Do we have enough evidence? And responded, well, just take a look at some of the positions that he's taken in his rulings, right? As if the fact that he's a conservative or an originalist judge somehow means that now we're supposed to think he is guilty of sexual assault, or we should actually not even care whether he's guilty of sexual assault and just assume that he did it, forget about the truth, forget about finding out what happened, because he has politics that we don't like. And when everybody last week was, not everybody, but everyone on the left was making fun of Kyle Rittenhouse for crying, it reminded me of when they made fun of Brett Kavanaugh for crying in defense of himself and getting angry and worked up, tearing up, in defense of his good name. And you just know that if these people confirmed the political preferences of the left, we'd be hearing about how strong men cry and real men show emotion, right? And conservatives just don't understand this because they're emotionless sociopaths. That's what we would be hearing about. And because the politics are reversed, we have people lying, mocking him. We have President Biden calling him a white supremacist, even though all of the people that he shot were white. There's no evidence whatsoever that he's a neo-Nazi, a white supremacist, had any race-based motivations for being anywhere that night or doing anything that he did. No one cares about, well, fewer and fewer people care about what's true, finding out what actually happened and doing justice according to it. They care about their political ends and saying and doing what they have to do in any given circumstance to get that.
So, Charlie, did anything that you heard yesterday change your mind, your basic take on this case? And just let me preview your answer. Let me note what my thoughts were. So it seems to me when after he shot Rosenbaum and he's walking down the street, well, the basic problem the prosecution has in every instance, he's running away, right? He's trying to run away. And after he shot Rosenbaum, he's walking away. As the defense points out, he's not shooting anyone randomly on the streets. He's walking towards the police. Now, the prosecution says some of these people knew, at least one guy knew, that he'd shot Rosenbaum. So he's getting followed for that reason. But if they just let him go, nothing bad is going to happen. He's going to go and surrender to the police. Then he, you know, guy throws knocks his hat off with a rock. He falls to the ground. Guy hits him with a skateboard. And then you have the confrontation with the guy with the Glock. It seems to me all that's really easy to defend. It just seems clear self-defense to me because he was in real jeopardy of severe bodily harm and perhaps being killed in that instance. The one, I think, if the jury gets him on anything, maybe it's the Rosenbaum because he could have kept on running. But the thing is, you know, he did slow down when he was going in between the cars, and the prosecution was like, it's his fault. He slowed down. That's how Rosenbaum got close. But then Rosenbaum was really close, and the prosecution makes a big deal how far away Rosenbaum was when he was, you know, 2, 3, 4 feet in closing. And in fact, you know, there's soot on Rosenbaum's hand because he was lurching towards the gun. So even that to me seems self-defense, but that's the one I kind of wonder what the jury will think. But where are you on this?
I think the prosecution has two big problems. The first is that both lawyers for the prosecution are incompetent, unlikable, lacking in fluency, poor at judging tone, mediocre at best. The second is that the charges that have been brought simply don't tally with the evidence. Until the prosecution convinced the judge to allow the inclusion of some lesser charges in the last few days, which I should say is a tactic I loathe. It is illiberal. It is a strategy of throwing charges at the wall in the hope something will stick, in the hope the jury will back into a lesser charge that was not presented at first. But until that moment, all of the charges, with the exception of the weapons charge, which was subsequently dismissed, were first-degree charges. Now, first-degree charges are the most serious charges that you can bring because they imply intent. Had the prosecution from the beginning brought, I don't know if they have this in Wisconsin, they do in some states, a third degree charge, say depraved heart, they might have had a better time of it. If they had said, in essence, he shouldn't have been there, and this law will back this up, he shouldn't have brought a gun there. But they didn't. They brought first degree charges, first degree homicide, first degree intent to kill, and the equivalent of depraved heart charges in the first degree. And in order to support those charges, you have to convince a jury that Rittenhouse went there with the intent to start shooting people. which is a theory that really is only supportable if you haven't followed the case. This is the theory that the loudest voices on Twitter are still clinging to inexplicably after days and days and days of a trial in which it has been unsubstantiated. So I still don't care whether Kyle Rittenhouse is a good person or a bad person. I don't care whether he was judicious or injudicious in going. I don't care whether he crossed state lines or not. I care about the charges. And until the last few days, when the prosecution, in essence, admitted that it has failed to make its case, or that it is worried that it has failed to make its case, and so brought in lesser charges as a backup, the charges that Wisconsin brought against the guy simply don't tally with what we know happened, certainly not beyond a reasonable doubt. So where am I on this? I think that the state made a mistake. I think that it was motivated politically to charge Rittenhouse as flamboyantly as it could. And I suspect, of course we'd never know, that the jury is going to confirm its mistake by acquitting him, especially now that the only charge I could have seen being upheld, the weapons charge, has been dismissed. That weapons charge really should have been dismissed if the prosecution's theory of it were correct. The prosecution's reading of the law were correct, Rittenhouse would have been guilty. But the law is so vague and contradictory that I think the judge made the right call in throwing it out.
So, Jim Garrity, next question to you. We asked this last week, but haven't had heard you or Zan on it. Will Rittenhouse be found innocent of all charges or found guilty of something?
I'm going to guess innocent of all charges, but as I said at the beginning of this conversation, juries are weird and unpredictable and don't always, they always come back. They always have the possibility of coming back and surprising you.
Zan.
I think most likely he'll be found innocent of everything. The trial went about as well as it could have for him. But yeah, the Jim's caveat's definitely true.
Charlie, you're still innocent?
Yeah, I think so. And I also think that if he is convicted of anything, he would be likely to prevail on appeal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm still innocent of everything. If he's found guilty, it'll clearly be because of some of the chaff thrown up by the prosecution. He shouldn't have been there. He was looking for trouble. He lied about, his medical training and what had happened when he was there on the ground. He didn't render aid to any of these people. He didn't seem concerned about them. And I think they land some blows with that stuff, but it's not really relevant to the underlying charges. This was clearly self-defense. He was not the aggressor in any of these instances. He was retreating. He was running away. He did not fire on anyone who was retreating or was not obviously a threat of some sort or other. So I'm still where I was last week. This will be a shocking miscarriage of justice if he is found guilty on any of these charges. With that, let's hear from our first sponsor this episode, Ball and Branch Sheets. And we're going to our great champion of Ball and Branch Sheets, Charlie Cook.
We spend one third of our lives in bed. So pure organic cotton sheets from Ball and Branch make a truly special gift. They make the highest quality sheets over at Ball and Branch by doing things the right way, not the easy way. And I know this because I sleep on Ball and Branch sheets myself every single night for one third of my life. And they are absolutely terrific, very comfortable. Florida is obviously pretty warm, so they're nice and breathable. And we've got the classic white sheets. I think my wife wouldn't go for anything more funky than that, but they are a very nice white. Two, they're created by husband and wife team, Scott and Missy Tannen, who founded Ball and Branch to create a new standard in bedding by doing things the right way. Ball and Branch hold themselves to high standards across the board, from sourcing pure organic cotton to putting workers' rights first. And it's not just their sheets that are made the right way. Their pillows, bath towels, and robes are too. The signature hemmed sheets are the all-time bestseller, and they're beloved for so many reasons, like how they get softer with every single wash, the buttery, soft, lightweight, made with 100% organic cotton weave feel. That feels incredible in all seasons, comes with a wide range of colors and all sizes, from twin up to California King, and they are completely toxin-free and fair trade certified. So if you want to treat yourself and your loved ones to the new standard in bedding from Boll & Branch, you can. Their gifts come wrapped and ready in their special holiday packaging. And if you order by the 19th of December, you will get guaranteed delivery by Christmas. And even better, you can get up to 20% off your order over the next week with promo code EDITORS15 at bollandbranch.com. That's B-O-L-L and branch.com. And then if you enter promo code EDITORS15 for the next week, you will get 20% off your order. See the site for details, and exclusions may apply.
Thank you, Charlie. Everyone, please check out Boll & Branch sheets. So, Zan, it's a cardinal rule of political life that if the White House press secretary has to tweet at 9 p.m. on a Sunday evening about how central and important the vice president is, the vice president probably isn't that central or important. And Jen Psaki was prompted to do this by a spate of articles about tensions between Kamala Harris and the White House. And the CNN story is just absolutely incredible. And the crux of it from the Harris perspective is that you have this great historic figure, Kamala Harris, and all she needs to make history every single day is to be deployed in the proper manner. And she's been totally let down by the White House that instead of deploying her in historic manners is giving her these difficult jobs with very little upside. Meanwhile, the White House, you can just feel the eye rolling in all the anonymous statements in this piece. Obviously, just considers her a bother, maladroit in important respects. There's just a perfect moment in this piece where you have Kamala Harris allies complaining that the White House went all out defending Pete Buttigieg's two-month paternal leave. Where they haven't defended Kamala Harris in that way. And this must be because Pete Buttigieg is a white man and Kamala Harris isn't. What do you make of it?
I mean, there's not a single word in the piece that I find remotely surprising. I remember, I guess, what was it, 2 years now or a year back? Like, wow, time really feels like it's flying in a strange way these days. About a year ago, a little more than a year ago, when they picked her as the vice president, I remember not being surprised at all because Biden promised he was going to pick a black woman as his running mate. And she was the most obvious, most well-known selection, highest name recognition, had run for president herself, who filled that identity slot. But I also remember thinking, could he possibly have done anything worse for himself? Because, okay, great, she fills the identity slot he promised to fill, but she's a terrible politician, right? She dropped out of the Democratic primary and at the time was polling at 3%. And I think she, as a politician, what she did in the presidential primary, what she's done as vice president, what she did on the ticket before becoming vice president, what she did as a senator, for that matter, is just evidence that this identity politics mold can actually, or this identity politics model can be damaging to people who embrace it, because you actually aren't doing yourself any favors as a political party or as a movement if you advance people based on the color of their skin. Who would have thought? If you put someone in a prominent role because of her gender or her skin color, and she's actually not popular, she's odd and kind of strange as a politician, right? She doesn't really ever say anything that sounds natural. She comes across as angry in context when she shouldn't. You know, her debate with Mike Pence was, I think, condescending, unpleasant, not fun to watch. And I'm not saying that because she's a woman, right? If a man had done it, I would have thought the same thing. None of that was rescued by the fact that she had the quote unquote right skin color. And I think you're seeing that in pieces like this. She thinks she's entitled to a particular role, a particular type of treatment because she fills this identity slot for the administration or for the party. But the party doesn't want her out in front because she's unpopular and she's bad at what she does. And they wisely are trying to, I guess, fill the identity slot and have people clap for them while keeping her under wraps.
Yeah, Jim, this is a classic instance. This wasn't a promise that Biden needed to make, to pick a woman and pick a woman of color, because then his options were fairly limited. And Kamala Harris seemed the most prominent and promising in that bucket. But Biden didn't have any relationship with her. She's not any good. I mean, it's just obvious. Any political observer can just watch her for 15 minutes and realize this is not a natural at all. And they're now reaping the whirlwind. I think a USA Today poll, I think, had her at 28% approval. I mean, how do you get to 20? How do you get to 28% as a vice president?
Yeah, how did she get that high?
Unless you're Spiro Agnew, it's not as though she's actually, you know, she's not out there every day in the front of people's minds. There's just an inherent dislike of her. And it's not because she's a woman. It's not because she's a minority. It's because she's Kamala Harris.
So what we see with this piece by CNN, which is part of a continuing series, Politico's written a bunch of these kind of stories, Axios has written these kinds of stories. Let's go all the way back to 2008. Barack Obama selects Joe Biden to be his running mate. But when these things get worked out, there are a lot of details that need to get ironed out by the chiefs of staff and by the two parties of the two people. It's almost like a wedding, because they're going to be together for, you know, ideally 8 years. And the deal that Obama put on the table for Joe Biden was, you can bring over a handful of your longtime staffers, but the rest of your staff as vice president, I want you to pick my people. Now, I'll give you a choice. You can hire I'll give you a menu of all the people that I have, but my people come first, and they are the people who will make up your staff. And some of this is to make sure that, you know, all the friends of Barack Obama end up with good jobs in the White House and in the executive branch. But it's also to make sure I don't want you creating your own little separate power base within my administration with your own goals as opposed to mine. Well, Joe Biden selects Kamala Harris, and there's a very similar setup. And as I went through in yesterday's Morning Jolt, if you look at the people around Kamala Harris, they are not longtime Kamala Harris staffers who were with her in the Senate, with her in the presidential campaign, her days as California Attorney General or District Attorney. There are handfuls. Rohini Kosulu, who is her domestic policy advisor. But everybody else, chief of staff, deputy chief of staff, spokesperson, communications director, national security advisor, they're all people who joined Kamala Harris in December 2019, January 2020. She is not surrounded by her longtime staff. So the first thing is that Kamala Harris might not feel like she's surrounded by people who are the best, or that she would have chosen, or that are, who truly have her interests, best interests at heart. But that means all the people who were with Kamala Harris in her Senate office, all the people who were with Kamala Harris on her presidential campaign, didn't get hired for those jobs. And those people are all still floating around Washington. So when CNN calls up and say, hey, what do you think of the team around Kamala Harris? It's very easy to imagine people saying, oh, those idiots, they don't know what they're doing. They don't know how to use Kamala Harris the right way. They're not serving her correctly. She's being very poorly served by the people around here. And some of that might be genuine assessment, and some of that might be sour grapes.
But Jim, this has been the storyline forever with her. It's always she's being poorly served by her staff that she doesn't get along with and has huge turnover with. I mean, this was happening before she was in the vice president's office.
Yeah, the other, you know, point five in my five observations of yesterday is I think deep down, Kamala Harris doesn't actually know what she wants to do. Because if you think about it, you know, she all throughout her presidential campaign, she kept flip-flopping. Medicare for all, issue after issue, you know, sanctuary cities, all kinds of law enforcement and criminal justice reform. She found herself on both sides of both issues. And at the heart, you know, Kamala Harris wants to be popular, but she also wants to please the progressive base. And she kept taking these positions. Oh, we're going to get rid of private health insurance. And then there'd be a backlash. And she's like, oh, I didn't really mean it that way. No. What I mean was, in the end, if you're a principal, you know, politician, you're willing to withstand some unpopularity. You're willing to say, this is the right thing to do. And I don't care what the poll numbers say. And I don't care if certain people don't like me. And deep down, there's like something very insecure about Kamala Harris. I think it's where that nervous laugh comes from. It's where just eagerness to please and that kind of, you know, faux folksiness comes through in all of her appearances and all that kind of stuff. So I think in the very beginning, this was a This was not a match made in heaven. This was actually a very awkward match between the two. There are still Biden people who don't trust her and haven't forgotten that debate shot calling Joe Biden racist for his position on busing way back in the 70s. There's still a lot of bad blood between these two teams. So I don't think, you know, the Harris team can count on a lot of sympathy or for the rest of the Biden administration to come rushing to her aid. And then kind of one of the other points I made yesterday, Joel, is kind of the variation of the Charlie Cook question about Joe Biden. What is Kamala Harris good at? It's not foreign policy. She's got very little experience there. She doesn't have relationships on the Hill. Maybe it's law enforcement and criminal justice and prosecutorial stuff, and maybe the judicial system. But they already have an attorney general. So what's left for Kamala Harris to do? If they think she's being poorly used, I'd really love to know from Kamala Harris herself, how does she think she should be used? Because I'm not sure that would actually be all that different from what we're seeing now.
Yeah, and then also, there's just the issue that this White House has other things to worry about besides propping up its vice president.
They need to prop up the president. So Charlie,
yeah, exactly. That should be the highest priority. Speaking of that, Charlie, Byron York had a good piece yesterday, a friend of the Washington Examiner, that you know the background to this, and another Kamala Harris piece was in Politico, and that piece, the frame of that was there's this competition between Kamala Harris and Pete Buttigieg to be the Biden successor if he doesn't run in 2024. Now, Biden says he's going to run in 2024, but even a lot of Democrats doubt that. But the background here is the weakness of Biden, you know, politically, obviously, but then also just in terms of his standing, you know, he's 78 years old, obviously lost a step and probably has some more lost steps to come. So you have this early jockeying. Who's going to step into his shoes if he's not running in 2024?
Kamala Harris is, as she was before she was vice president, the answer to a question nobody asked. She's not disliked because she's a non-white woman. She's vice president because she's a non-white woman. And amazingly enough, it's not actually enough to be a non-white woman. There is nothing to recommend her. There has never been anything to recommend her. She is a talentless authoritarian with a tin ear and a cackle that makes Hillary Clinton look like Mr. Rogers. She has never said in her entire life a single thing that is interesting or informative or substantive or aids the debate. And that is a separate question from whether I agree with her. Jim said, what's she good at? What has she ever said? One thing that she has ever said that was interesting or useful. I cannot tell you how much hope it gives me for the future that voters hate Kamala Harris as much as they seem to do. I wrote a piece saying good riddance to Kamala Harris when she dropped out with 3% support early on in the primary in 2019. And somehow she got back in. She was elevated and stalled.
despite your piece, Charlie.
No, despite getting 3% in the primary. And now she's twisting in the wind and it's glorious. But as you point out, Rich, it's not just her that's twisting in the wind. This would be a different story if Joe Biden were really popular, but Kamala Harris were not. If Joe Biden were doing well, but Kamala Harris were not. If Joe Biden, subject to his health and willingness to run, were a keen prospect for 2024 and Kamala Harris were not. At that point, you say, okay, Joe Biden did what he thought he had to do. He's not threatened by his vice president. Looks like a good move. But it doesn't look like a good move now, does it? In fact, it looks like a generational disaster for the Democrats. They've got a very unpopular, weak, 78-9-year-old man as president. The presumptive replacement has a 28% approval rating. The fight, if the party were to get rid of them both, would be a bloodbath. You think you've seen identity politics nastiness? You wait until the Democratic Party, out of rational self-interest tries to replace Kamala Harris, and especially tries to replace her with Pete Buttigieg, the white man's white man. What a mistake. What a mess they have made for themselves, and they deserve every last ounce of it.
It turned out Joe Biden needed his own Joe Biden, someone even older than him that no one thought was actually going to run, had any chance of running for president after he was done. So, Zan, exit question to you. Kamala Harris will be Democratic presidential nominee either in 2024 or 2028. Yes or no?
There's no way that's going to happen. No.
Jim?
I'm going to surprise everyone and say yes.
Which year?
I'm going to say 2024. I'm going to say the health issues will catch up to Joe Biden. You know, all of our suspicions that there's something wrong with him will be, confirmed sometime between now and then. And they'll say, oh, his health is declining or something like that. And I think that just as Joe Biden was the consensus choice after a, surprisingly heated 2020 Democratic primary, I think Democrats will fear the consequences of denying the first African-American woman vice president the nomination more than they will fear defeat in 2024.
Charlie Cook.
If Joe Biden does not run in 2024, it's going to be difficult for the Democrats to extricate themselves from the Kamala Harris disaster. When was the last time that happened? The vice president is always the presumptive nominee. I think the last time the vice president was not chosen as the nominee was the 50s. And if there is an internecine fight, it will destroy the Democrats' ticket. You cannot survive a rough primary when you're the party in power. If it's 2028, no way. Absolutely not. Not that it will matter by then. If Joe Biden has been president for two terms, the Republicans are winning the White House. But I think Kamala Harris is, oddly enough, in a strong position to be the candidate and an extremely weak position to become president.
So if she's not already president, there's no way that she's the nominee in 2028. I totally agree with that. No way. So 2024 is the real option. And if something, God forbid, we're not wishing this, but there's some health crisis where Kamala Harris becomes president before 2024, she will be the presidential nominee in 2024. If, however, just Biden is just kind of not up for it, another run, and says he's not running, there will be challengers. I mean, just she is so weak. There's no way that people aren't going to run against her. I don't care about the woman and race thing. I know that will be a huge factor, but people are going to run. And I just don't think she's a vote getter. I don't think she would win a Democratic nomination if she actually has to go out there and win votes. So with that, let's pause and hear from our second sponsor this episode, the Thinking Fellows podcast. Reasonable and rational conversations are hard to come by. The Thinking Fellows podcast, a part of 1517.org and the 1517 podcast network, has been hosting reasonable and rational conversations about the history and development of Christian thought for the last 6 years. They invite you to join four of their scholars in engaging and informed conversations about theology, history, and apologetics, all from a classical Christian perspective. During the month of November, the Thinking Fellows will be discussing the life and work of C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien. Their work is as timely as ever as they address the challenges that secularism and progressivism pose to Christianity and the foundations of moral and political order, both then and now. So search your favorite podcasting app for the Thinking Fellows today to join the conversation and find them, all their BB projects, and the entire 1517 podcast network at 1517.org. That's 1517.org. Please check it out. Once again, the Thinking Fellows podcast. So, Charlie, speaking of really unimpressive politicians from the Democrats' 2020 primary field, Beto O'Rourke is in it to win it once again in Texas. He's going to run for governor, this might have been a more plausible proposition if it weren't for the wreckage of his presidential campaign, which one, was really embarrassing, but two, led him to adopt all sorts of positions that are going to be really hard to explain to a Texas electorate, even one that electorate that's a little less red than it used to be, but Medicare for All, Green New Deal, and taking people's AR-15s is just not a winning platform.
I was highly amused by a tweet from Logan Dobson, who wrote, "Look, mock Beto all you want, but the fact is in Texas, you can't collect unemployment without proof that you're actively looking for work." This guy is becoming a perennial candidate. He's at risk of becoming Texas's Charlie Crist, except Charlie Crist actually won a gubernatorial election at one point. I don't know why it is so hard for left-leaning analysts and voters to comprehend that Beto's just not that good. I mean, leave aside the likely makeup of the Texas electorate. I'm not as convinced as you, Rich, that it's becoming less red. I think we're seeing something happen among Hispanic voters in Texas. I think we could see a more red electorate in 2022 than we did in 2020 or 2018. But this was a guy who couldn't unseat Ted Cruz, in a Democratic wave year. Now, you might say the advantages were in Cruz's favor, yes. But what does he think is going to happen next year? It's going to be a smashing Republican wave year. I don't know how big the wave will be. There's a long way to go. But it is going to happen. And if you look at the parts of the country that seem to be most up for ushering in a smashing Republican wave year, they're counties in Texas and Florida. So you have a guy who is not that talented, who has, since he last ran, adopted a whole host of absurd positions that are almost perfectly calibrated to lose him Texas. Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15. Running in a year that will be the polar opposite of the last time he ran. Why? What is it that he has to offer that makes him feel that he is necessary, that he is in any way useful to his movement? There's something missing in him, clearly. There's something that needs public affirmation. But he's not going to get it. He's going to lose once again. Maybe if he does, then we won't have to hear about him anymore. A man who has done nothing of consequence in his entire political career except put his name on the ballot.
So I have a confession to make, Charlie. That answer sounded very compelling, but during that answer, I actually went, answered the door, accepted a UPS delivery that I had to sign for, and then came back in time to get the finale of your answer. So that's what a talented podcast host can do. So Jim, it seems like Beto really missed his chance, you know, that Pete got, which is a cabinet position. You know, he's someone, obviously, he's not going to go out and do anything else. He wants to be in politics, and being, you know, the transportation secretary or HUD secretary or whatever would have been a natural for him. But going back and making the second try is not going to end well in Texas.
Rich, I'm just going to take a moment and stew in frustration that you got a package delivered and I haven't, where I'm waiting for my good microphone.
Yeah, who's complaining about the supply chain?
Supply chains. Mine's probably sitting on some boat off the coast of California right now. So I'm going to quote our podcast colleague, Charlie Cook, who observed that Joe Biden has said, Beto's going to come with me to Washington and help us work out gun violence, whatever, you know, some sort of, he made some sort of comment that indicated that Beto O'Rourke would be in the Biden administration and doing something on gun control.
He's going to be his point man.
That's right. Thank you, Charlie. And that hasn't happened. His invitation must have gotten lost in the mail. And, you know, interestingly, the other person who was, you know, you might have figured might have been on the list at some point, Julian Castro, the former mayor of San Antonio and secretary of HUD, who suggested that Biden was having memory lapses in one of the debates. And I think that was the last anybody ever saw of Julian Castro. Last I saw him was on the side of a milk carton. He did not get invited to join the Biden administration. So Beto was getting the same treatment as the guy who'd kind of, you know, insulted Biden and gone after him personally. I wrote about this in the corner yesterday. This is good news for Texas Governor Greg Abbott. This is good news for Republicans in general. Beto O'Rourke, give him a little bit of credit. He made the 2018 Senate race against Ted Cruz competitive, and he apparently had some good down ticket effects for Texas Democrats. And that's more than a lot of Texas Democrats have done since the days of Ann Richards back in the early to mid 90s. So to credit where that's due, that's something. He didn't win. And he had, I believe at the time, like $80 million, more money than anybody had ever raised for a Senate race ever before. And as we wrote about many times at National Review, just about every major national publication, except National Review, went down and hung out with Beto O'Rourke and gushed about what a rock star he was and his sweat, that Peter Hamby just couldn't write enough about his sweat and how cool he was. And he loved Whataburger. And, you know, it was like the nerdy kids got a chance to hang out with the cool kids for once. And it was just, and you read these 12-page profiles, and Texas Monthly had one that just went on for pages and pages. And you kept waiting for, okay, what's he done though? And the answer was that he was on the El Paso City Council. And then he hustled to beat a Democratic incumbent for a House seat. And then he was in the minority in the House for a bunch of years. He didn't do that much. And there was just this unbelievable height to performance ratio. Then he runs for president. And I think, you know, lots of listeners probably remember that, you know, Vanity Fair cover with him smiling, looking out, looking all manly with his sleeves rolled up saying, "I'm in it to win it," or something, right? You know, I was born to do this. Not much sense of what this is. And I strongly suspected that Beto O'Rourke has run for Senate, ran for president, and is now running for governor, all in an attempt to kickstart his music career again. He really seems like a guy who'd be happier on tour giving performances to sold out arenas than to actually doing any governing work. I don't think he's going to do particularly well, but what he may do is an echo of his 2018 Senate bid, and that he may get national Democrats, grassroots donors across the country donate to him. Maybe they're sick of him jumping up on tables. Maybe they're sick of the Whataburger and the rock star stories and all that. Maybe they're sick, and maybe he'll be a shadow of his former self. I kind of think that's a good chance then. But it's still, it's going to be a ton of money going to a race that's something of a long shot. And Beto O'Rourke could be this cycle's version of Jamie Harrison, who was running against Lindsey Graham back down in South Carolina. Bad polling told you Jamie Harrison was in it real close, and Democrats could win a Senate seat in South Carolina. And then Lindsey Graham won by 10 percentage points. It was never that close. These are red states, guys.
I just want to add something very quickly. The money is something of a drag for Democrats. I understand the argument that Beto could help down ticket. That obviously meant a great deal more in 2018 than it's going to in 2022. The money comes, most of it, it seems, from outside Texas. And some of it comes from people who live in competitive states. I was astonished back in 2018, the number of people I saw on the news or on Twitter or met in real life, who, while Florida had a gubernatorial race between Andrew Gillum and Ron DeSantis, and a Senate race between Rick Scott and Bill Nelson, were sending cash to Texas to support Beto. Mm-hmm. Now, those races in Florida were won by 30,000 and 10,000 votes, respectively. I'm not saying that's what did it, but the last thing you want if you're a party going into the midterms with severe headwinds is too many celebrity candidates who attract the attention of low-information voters in other states and rob those states of support that they need.
Yeah. So Zan, in 18, you know, Beto came within 2 points of Ted Cruz, and there was a lot, Jim's absolutely right, of ridiculous media puffery of Beto, but he did have a thing going on. You know, he was fresh, he was skateboarding, he was playing air guitar in his car waiting in the drive-through of Whataburger. And I was one of those who tends to think no one really loses that much for running for president. So go ahead, Beto. Maybe it catches fire. Maybe something happens. And very soon after the tabletop jumping happened, it was just clear that no, this is standing on counters at coffee shops is just not that cool. And there was not enough. He wasn't a substantive enough figure to make it happen in presidential politics. And then he's laid all this groundwork that's going to make it really hard for him to return to Texas politics. So this was clearly a case where someone was hurt by running for president.
Yeah, I really don't understand. I'm hard pressed to comprehend the case for Beto running for governor in Texas. If you're a Democrat who thinks that maybe the state is shifting, and you know, closer to the middle or is winnable for Democrats at the state level, wouldn't you want a Democrat running who, you know, might be somewhere closer to the middle or, you know, popular in the state? And, you know, as you said, he did come within 2.5 points, I think 3 points of Ted Cruz. But that's Ted Cruz, right? So the idea that he's going to do better against Greg Abbott, I'm not sure is true. I'm not sure that he has really anything on his side. He's probably going to spend a lot of time talking about the way the state handled the horrible crisis with the snow earlier this year. But people probably, you know, maybe not totally forget it, but they probably won't blame the state government fully enough to swing an election to a Democrat. He's probably going to spend a lot of time talking about the heartbeat bill, but the polling I've seen suggests that the heartbeat bill in Texas is actually popular among a majority of Texans. So spending a lot of time talking about women's reproductive rights is probably not going to go very well for him. And you just know that Greg Abbott and Republicans are going to have a whole tape queued up of everything he said during the presidential primary race that goes against even what Democrats, a huge number of Democrats in Texas think. And so if you actually do think this is winnable for a Democrat, I can't imagine why you'd think he would be the one to try it.
Exit question to you, Charlie Cook. If you were forced, which you're going to be, to choose among these figures, which in your view best represents the future of the Democratic Party, Kamala Harris, Pete Buttigieg, Eric Adams, or Amy Klobuchar?
I think Amy Klobuchar, but I think that in certain districts and cities, Eric Adams.
Jim Garrity.
I would just go with Eric Adams if for no other reason than his story is being written. I think most of the others have a good portion of their stories done.
Zan.
I think it'll be Pete Buttigieg, actually, at least at the national level. I think that the Democrats are shifting in a direction where politicians like him are the ones that they think they're supposed to be parading around. So that's what they're going to do.
Yeah, I think it's probably Buttigieg. You know, it's a upper middle class, technocratic, affluent party in large part, not entirely, with the wokeism mixed in. So he's, you know, he's in the woke and the identity politics. So Buttigieg has some of that identity politics, obviously. Kamala Harris has some more. So maybe it's somewhere in between Buttigieg and Harris. But I think for Republicans, the scary prospect would be if it's Eric Adams, you know, someone who's genuinely tough on crime, who has a certain common sense sensibility to him as an African-American former cop. And if Democrats could find someone at that like that at the national level, I think they would be in a much better place than obviously if they end up, say, stuck with Kamala Harris. With that, let me do a quick NR Plus plug. NR Plus is the digital subscription service at nationalreview.com. It is your way to avoid the increasingly extensive, and I mean extensive, we're almost paywalling everything now on nationalreview.com, which I know can block what you want to read, which is the point of the paywall. Unfortunately, very easy way to get around it is just to give in and to pony up for a first-time subscription to NR Plus. The paywall goes away. Almost all the ads go away as well. If you sign up and log in, you can comment. You can be invited to various special events with our writers and editors and special guests. So it's a great deal, your way to support our valuable work and to plug further into our community and join the fight that we are waging every single day for the American cause. With that, let's hit a few other things before we go. Jim Garrity, your kitchen renovation, which listeners to this podcast have been able to experience in real time, a couple episodes or so, is not only done, you are now entertaining in your new kitchen.
I was going to say, does this podcast sound different, listeners? Is it not just because I don't have my good microphone, because I'm still waiting for the new one to arrive because of the supply chain crisis, but also you don't hear the, you know, and all the other stuff in the background.
Wow, that was a really good impression. Yeah. You've clearly got used to it.
Well, I've heard a lot. I've heard a lot of it.
In a prior life, a sound guy, Jim, that you could make these.
When they reboot Police Academy, I'll get to play the that guy. No, I was going to say, this week, past weekend, we finally had a chance to show this off. A couple of friends who'd been able to peek in at various points, but they got to see the final product and to entertain and to use all of our nifty kitchen gadgets and showcase all the counter space. And we're still adjusting. We're still, because all the cabinets are moved around, my wife and I are still at the point of putting stuff like the spatulas where we, each one of us thinks it goes, which is not where the other one thinks it goes. So we're going to still be working out some details of where is the spatula. It should go in that drawer, not that drawer, and things like that. But otherwise,
I'm touched that you think you're going to have any long-term say in where the spatulas go.
Well, here's the thing. It goes back where I put it back when I have it. So it's going to be this endless game of where does the spatula travel? It's like, where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? But so it's, you know, look, for all the aggravation you could probably hear in my voice month by month, it is terrific. And who knows, maybe I'll do a video or something to showcase to the world.
So Zan, you have started your sourdough starter.
I have, and it's been a long time coming. Any listeners out there who've been getting into the sourdough baking trend, I guess, have been doing it for quite a while now. I'm sure people started this during lockdown last year. I never got around to it because it sounds way more complicated than it actually is. It turns out all you have to do is put some flour and water in a jar, let it sit, and then kind of take some out, add some more flour, stir it around, and keep going until it turns into actual sourdough starter and you can bake with it. I'm on actually not even into the first 24 hours, so maybe it's harder than it seems, but thus far it's been fun and I can't wait to try baking with it.
So once during the lockdowns, I made French bread, which didn't turn out that great. It wasn't sort of as tight and crisp on the outside as you would hope, but I just found it just took too much effort because all the rising, you know, you stop, let it rise some more, stop, let it rise again. I found that kind of annoying. But Charlie, speaking of baking things, you were a judge in a cake baking competition.
Yes, among everyone else at the fundraiser that I went to. Let's not pretend that I have any expertise in this area. I was astonished by the sheer talent of the people who had baked these cakes, which were not only delicious, but were aesthetically marvelous. The best one, in my view, I think I was living vicariously for my kids, was the one that had a dragon wrapped around it, all the way from the bottom to the top. But unlike Zan, I haven't been doing any baking myself. I've just been watching other people bake and then getting to sample what they did, which was a matter of tremendous artistry.
So Jim mentioned going to a John Andrasik concert a couple months ago. John was actually on an NR Plus call last week. What a great guy. What a really thoughtful and talented musician. We had a great conversation and we were lucky he actually performed two songs live on this NR Plus call. One is his Blood on My Hands song, prompted by the disastrous pullout in Afghanistan, and the other was Superman, you know, one of his greatest hits. And that's just, I just love that song. It's just one of those songs that no matter how many times you've heard it, just kind of has an emotional pull, and it is moving. And just hearing him do it live for a small group of us was really extraordinary. So with that, let's go to our editor's picks. Jim Garrity, what's your pick?
I'm going to go with Charlie Cook. The title is No, We Don't Actually Need to Be More Like Europe. But I think what I really want to give credit to Charlie for is that on any given day, if you're reading sites beyond National Review, you come across something that strikes you as really stupid. And I think what triggered Charlie is that, you know, over at Bloomberg, Alison Schrager is writing about the supply chain crisis and says, you know, Americans can't spend the way they used to. Store shelves are emptying and it can take months to find a car, refrigerator, or sofa. If this continues, we may need to learn to do without, and horrors live more like the Europeans. That might actually not be a bad thing. What's she saying? We just fume about it, and then we move on. And what a lot of things make Charlie special, but one of them is that instead of just throwing up his hands or throwing something at the screen or something like that, Charlie has the patience and intellectual firepower to say, well, no, you're completely wrong on this. It would be bad for Americans to live more like Europeans. And it doesn't say that Europe's a bad place or, the Europeans are free to live the way they want to live, but to talk about the glories of the free market and that we are not put here on Earth to basically micromanage the choices of other people. You have the free market. People buy what they want to buy. And if they want to buy stuff you think is wasteful, that's fine, right? But the idea is that this constant free exchange of ideas, this constant free exchange of goods and services allows good ideas to thrive. And when you have these much more limited systems like they have in Europe, you get fewer of these good ideas. It's a terrific piece. And it's a great sense of not just, raging or fuming about something, but calmly and rationally, at least on paper, maybe Charlie's screaming the whole time he's writing this, I don't know, laying out why the free market is good and why we should not be looking at the supply chain crisis as a blessing in disguise or something like that.
Zan, what's your pick?
My pick is from the latest issue of the National Review magazine. It's our end row issue. And my pick is a piece by Clark Forsyth called Roe and Stare Decisis. He's just an expert on the history of Roe, on the legal flaws in Roe v. Wade. And I think his piece is especially important given that to the extent that conservatives are concerned about the upcoming ruling in Dobbs, some fear that John Roberts is going to come up with some stare decisis reason to keep Roe and Casey in place, or at least parts of them. And I think Clark does an excellent job of explaining why that argument does not work.
Charlie, what's your pick?
I'm nervous it's going to be the same as your pick because you mentioned its topic earlier in the podcast.
Let me predict, you're taking MBD's piece on tears.
I have a
backstop, so go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm taking MBD.
I'm prepared with two editor's picks, Charlie.
That's right. You're really showing me up. I sometimes have none. I am picking MBD's piece on Rittenhouse crying in the media reaction to it. Sometimes it's hard to convey how crazy the way that the press and many in the press are. And Michael manages it here. The opening line is, have you noticed that a lot of psychos have access to the media lately? And he runs through the really bizarre reaction to Rittenhouse crying on the stand, which he points out could be quickly answered by Occam's razor. But instead, we need an elaborate theory for it. It has to be this. The tears have to have a color. It has to be part of this other social foundation. It has to be an act of aggression. It has to say so much about America. It has to imply this or that about the trial. It doesn't. I thought it was really, really well done.
It was really well done. Also well done is a piece by Arthur Herman of the Hudson Institute, sometime contributor of ours, who's written a lot of history books. And he takes on this really idiotic tweet by Nicole Hannah Jones, where she says one of the things we should be ashamed of is that we dropped the bomb on Japan at the end of World War II. And she said Japan was just willing to surrender without us dropping the bombs, and everyone knew this, but we dropped them anyway. And just Herman demolishes this argument, which unsurprisingly traces back to Howard Zinn's egregious, tendentious anti-American history of the United States. So that's it for us. You've been listening to the National View podcast, and your rebroadcast, retransmission, or account of this game without the express written permission of National View magazine is strictly prohibited. This podcast has been produced by the incomparable Sarah Schutte, who makes us sound better than we deserve. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Zan. Thank you, Jim. And thanks to Ball and Branch and the Thinking Fellows podcast. And thanks especially to all of you for listening. We're the editors. We'll see you next time.